as is our custom in the As Time Goes By service. Today we will hear three short talks from members of our congregation with their thoughts on their lives over the passage of time. Our first speaker is Candace Sage. Candace was born in Northwest Indiana, earned degrees in English from Indiana University, then obtained her law degree in 1995. Candace worked in the computer field until entering law school, and then practiced law from 1995 till 2008, when she moved to San Diego. Candace has been a UU for 16 years and a member of UUFSD for the past five. She has been a member of our membership committee and now serves as a facilitator for the Sacred Circle groups. Please give Candace a warm welcome.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. He's a bit taller than I am. Good morning. What struck me in thinking over how time has gone by in my life is how much family stories have played a part in shaping who I am. I think I started to realize how important the stories of our lives are when I began volunteering for a local hospice. I deliver small flower arrangements, and if the patient is available, I also get a chance to visit. What I do is ask questions, and before long, I began to hear the stories of their lives. As these patients are nearing the end of their journey, I found that they really want to tell their stories again. And it's not to tell them to me, it's to hear for themselves their own stories one more time. It is my privilege to listen. So I began thinking about what stories I would want to hear about how my maternal grandfather immigrated to this country from Hungary in 1906 at age 16. The local priest in his village had warned him to leave to avoid being conscripted into the army of the Emperor Franz Joseph. My grandfather first stopped in Pittsburgh, where his father was working in the steel mills and sending money home. His father told him to go to East Chicago, Indiana, where there was work at the new mills opening there. He took a train, found his way to the Hungarian community, and began working at Inland Steel, where he stayed for 49 years. Another story is of my maternal grandmother, who immigrated here from Hungary in 1910. She was 12 years old and had been taken in by her uncle to help care for his large family. Her uncle had started a business in East Chicago, Indiana, and brought his family over, including my grandmother. They arrived on the 1st or 2nd of July. My grandmother, 12 years old, who spoke no English, was sent out to sell firecrackers on the corner in front of her uncle's store. She had no idea why, being unaware of the significance of the upcoming 4th of July. These were tough people, my grandparents. On the day my mother was born, during a freak October snowstorm, my grandfather gathered coal spilled along the railroad tracks to use to heat their house, because the delivery trucks couldn't reach them. A year later, upon learning that my grandfather had been stricken with the Spanish flu at work and had been taken to the hospital, my grandmother boarded a bus, checked him out of the hospital, brought him home, and nursed him back to health. My mother was as tough as her parents. She graduated from high school in the middle of the Depression. She tried to earn enough money to go to college, but could not. Soon she married my father, and they had six children, four living and two dying soon after birth. My parents always lived hand to mouth. My father was a construction carpenter, and often there wasn't enough work. When there was work, my dad was quick to spend whatever money he had. A nickel never got warm in his pocket. So when my mother was left a small inheritance by her father in 1957, My dad promptly started spending it. Worried that the money would be gone in no time, my mother did what was pretty radical at the time. She opened an account at the local savings and loan in her own name. That infuriated my father, but not nearly as much as what she did next. She enrolled in college. She had always wanted to be a teacher, and she saw this as her opportunity. Three children were still at home. My next oldest sister and myself were in high school, and my brother was in elementary school. My mother never missed a meal, never missed keeping up with the house, often studying late into the night. My dad did everything he could to obstruct her. Once, when I was a sophomore and I was typing a paper for one of my mother's classes, my dad started an argument with my mother and grabbed the typewritten sheets off the table where I was typing and ripped them into shreds. I rolled in a fresh sheet and started over. He ripped them up again. Finally, he went to bed, and I stayed up to finish the job. If she could persevere, so could I. My mother graduated in 4 years at the age of 45 with a 3.2 average. She taught for 23 years. My daughter, Jamie, likes to hear some of my own stories about how Walter Cronkite bought me a Coke during a break in CBS's coverage of the presidential primary in 1964. There was great interest in this primary because it was the first in a northern state, Indiana, where George Wallace was on the ballot seeking the Democratic nomination. A few months earlier, I, along with seven other students, had picketed Wallace when he came to Indianapolis to give a campaign speech. Anyway, on that May night, CBS had hired 92 young women, myself included, to sit by 92 telephones, one for each Indiana county, and report the vote tallies as they came in. It was hot, and at a break, I went to the back of the building to look for something to eat, drink. I was eyeing a soft drink machine when Cronkite came up to me and asked, in that wonderful deep voice of his, what drink I was going to buy. I told him I didn't have any money, just a bus token, so I was just looking. He said I looked like someone who needed a drink. And then popped a coin into the machine, asked me to select, and then gave me the bottle. Then there was a time I bluffed my way into finding out Bob Hope's room number at the campus hotel where he was staying. I knocked on the door, and Bob Hope himself opened it, and I was so stunned I didn't know what to say. He just laughed, asked me a few questions about school, and was as gracious a gentleman as I would have hoped. Another story I like to recall is how I held my breath together with a bunch of my colleagues as the space shuttle Columbia began its return to Earth after its maiden voyage. I worked on the thermal tile project, testing and retesting whether the tiles would remain attached during the rigors of launch. We would not know for sure until reentry. There's a short period of time where mission control loses contact with the shuttle as it re-enters the atmosphere. And that's when we held our breath. Then, when we thought our hearts were going to burst, Mission Commander John Young's voice came through. Houston, this is Columbia. We burst into cheers. In The Secret Life of Bees, Sue Monk Kidd wrote, stories have to be told or they die. And when they die, we can't remember who we are or why we're here. I've shared with you today a few of my stories. I encourage each of you to tell your own stories to whoever will listen, even if it's just yourself, because those stories are what make you you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Candace. Our next speaker is Bev Connor. Bev joined UUFSD in 2007. She's a former member of the choir, served as Joy Committee Chair, and as member of the Social Action Committee. And she has been the manager of many Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners that we've all enjoyed in recent years. We will be hearing the version of her life story that passed the censors. Please welcome Bev Connor.
Good morning again. Several months ago, sitting around with friends, a question about World War II came up. I answered the question before Google. How did you know that, they asked. Well, when you live to be 80 years old, you learn a lot of stuff. Now, I don't always remember everything, but my many experiences have taught me a lot. Many of you know me, and you don't know much about me. So in the next few minutes, I will share a few of the highlights that have made me the person I have become. I was born in East LA on the wrong side of the tracks. I knew it was the wrong side of the tracks, as we were the only Jewish family for blocks around. I come from a secular Jewish family. My sister and I were the only Jewish kids in school. And on Wednesday, when the nuns came to take the kids to catechism, I marched out with them and went to go play. My mother was born in France, so I told everyone that asked that I was French. Kids don't like to be different. I went to Hollenbeck Junior High School, and that is where I got my training wheels in protesting. There were quite a few Jewish kids in that school, and a well-known fascist was going to speak in our auditorium. In protest, we marched out of school shouting, "No more Nazis." We were suspended for a day, and so began my life as an activist. I come from a working-class family. My father was president of the union for 32 years. I learned the importance of the labor movement. I saw that his work mattered and that he was making a difference. As time marches on, we're now in the 1950s. I am in high school, and I admit I am not a great student, and my two main interests were girls' glee club and a cappella choir. And in my senior year, when I just needed 2 credits to graduate, I left school to get married. My husband and I moved to live in England for a year. He was part of the Air Force Engineers building bases. He had only 11 months to go, so we did not have access to U.S. housing or food. We lived in a Red Lion Inn for a few months. We found housing in a 200-year-old house we shared with no bathroom, a chamber pot chair, no stove or hot running water. Mr. Phipps, our landlord, cooked in the fireplace. Now, remember, I'm a city girl. I decided we needed to have a Thanksgiving dinner. I went looking in the garden for a potato bush or tree. Mr. Phipps was hysterical with laughter. Needless to say, the dinner was a disaster, and even with the real kitchen, I didn't know how to cook. A year after returning, I gave birth to my son, Steve. My mom came to stay with me, and when she left, I cried. I was a child having a child. But somehow, we learned to be parents. We bought a house with the help of a GI loan and moved to Whittier. I became a working mom, and during that time, I had several jobs. I learned some tough lessons about love, marriage, and divorce. I began working as a receptionist. I decided then best to go back to high school and earn those 2 missing credits. Then I went to East LA College, where I studied accounting. I then moved up into the company where I became the credit manager, and I was there for 22 years. In the 60s, I decided I wanted to learn to play the guitar. The lessons were held at the Unitarian Society of Whittier. I joined this very active congregation and soon joined the choir. Some of us became members of a performing folk singing group. We were called the Gentle Majority. We had four women and two men. We performed a wonderful tribute to Walt Whitman. The actor Sumner Kernan portrayed Whitman, and we sang the backup music for the recording. Sometimes I listened to the CD with tears, as so many of our group is no longer with us. During this time, our church was providing counseling for young people that wanted to become conscientious objectors. I was inspired to go to all the protest marches in Whittier and Los Angeles. I went to San Francisco and marched with 500,000 others to protest the war. I do believe that those protests around the country helped to end the war. In the late 70s, I became involved with the Holiday Project, a national organization. And during the holidays, we visited jails, prisons, retirement, convalescent homes, and juvenile halls. I began with this project in 1978. In this area, the group goes to the VA hospital, and I believe that the visitors get more out of it than those visited. In the 70s, I went with the social studies group with Orange Coast College to China. On our way to mainland China, we stopped in Korea, where there were soldiers with guns at the airport. I was shocked by this, forgetting about the Korean War. We stopped in Tokyo and from there to Taipei. We were the first tourists to land at the Hangzhou Airport in China. China was not yet ready for tourists. We were not allowed to travel around without our guides. In Shanghai, the Peace Hotel was the only hotel available. It was built in 1934 and was occupied by the Japanese during the war. I learned quickly to wear skirts or dresses. On the trains, we had to squat to go. Try keeping your balance on a moving train. I went with my son and his friends to an art show in Amsterdam. On the way, we stopped in England to show Steve where I lived with his father. The village, Steeple Aston, had not changed since the 1950s. In the late 80s and 90s, my son Steve and I owned the Basil Street Cafe, a vegetarian restaurant. If anyone tells you they would like to own a restaurant, just shake your head and walk away. Okay, it was not all bad. I have some fond memories. One Valentine evening, it was a dark and stormy night, a couple came into the restaurant and it was his intention to propose marriage. Due to the storm, the electricity failed, all the lights went out, the cooks were using flashlights, the tables all had candles. He did propose, and they came back every year, hoping to create the same romantic evening. In 06, I came to the fellowship, joined the choir, and I became a member in 2007. When asked by my friends why I joined the fellowship, the sense of community, the social justice activities, the choir, and mostly the wonderful friends and extended family I have found. So now you know a little about me. Through my travels, I learned that people are the same all over. I learned about the power of standing up for my values, and I have come to believe who I am can make a difference. Thank you.
Our final speaker is Roger Harmon. Roger and his wife Nancy have been members of UUFSD for about 3 years, and prior to that, members of the UU Church in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They moved to our area 5 years ago to assist Nancy's parents, who are now 91 and 94. Roger is an active member of our Social Action Committee and our men's group. This is the most recent of Roger's many moves, including from Kansas after college to Malawi, Africa, as a Peace Corps volunteer teacher, and on to Bangkok, Thailand, and Central Laos, where he taught and directed an English language program during the Vietnam-Southeast Asian War. He then returned to the U.S. for graduate studies in cultural anthropology. His doctorate was based on fieldwork in Thailand in the early 1970s. Roger will be speaking about embracing differences over the course of his life, moving from a small town, Western Kansas life, where cultural differences were minimal, to a life in which he sought out and embraced differences, differences that have given him enormous pleasure and meaning in his life. Please give Roger a warm welcome.
Thank you, John, and thanks to all of you for the chance to share stories with our friends, to hear other stories, to tell a part of my story, and hopefully to connect it to our effort to build a fellowship that works for all of us. It's been such a successful morning for me already because I gave my talk without any trouble at all. The last time I did a talk in a fellowship in a church, I had on my choir robe. The air conditioning was being fixed. I was supposed to give the talk, and I fainted once. They propped me back up. I tried again. I fell back again. So I'm on a roll, folks. And if I fail and faint once, I won't ask you to wait until I gather my forces. You can just leave. My focus is going to be today on what I learned about the power of developing deep relationships, often but not only cross-cultural ones, and in the process coming to embrace differences and connect with others through similarities. The story is rooted in the belief that everybody counts. Yes, everybody counts. After all, that is the essence of the first UU principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Did you also know it's part of our second principle? Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And did you know that it's also part of our third principle out of six? That is the acceptance of one another. So everybody counting really counts, I think. And I must say that I have not always believed or at least acted in a way that you could say that everybody counts. I like to say a little bit about that from my childhood. I was raised in Western Kansas, as John said, in the town of Greensburg, town of 2000. And a major influence during that time for myself and my older sister and my younger brother was to work in the grocery store that my dad managed. We worked for our allowance at the store during grade school, and in high school, we joined the payroll. Always had a few bucks in our pocket. I saw daily that Dad had a cheery hello for everybody, for every customer. He'd say hi, and he'd also call them by their first name. We kids were taught to speak to people, to respond when asked a question, to listen politely. Pretty good kids, really. People greeted each other in small towns in those days and chatted, and not even if it was only about the weather. Over time, people shared stories. Friendships developed. Alas, as a teen, there was always plenty of gossip, innuendo, casting doubt about the motives of good people, off-color jokes, jokes about Catholics, jokes about people of color. This and family tensions created uncertainty. I came to think about that Dad's friendliness was because he was talking to customers or potential customers. It has actually taken me decades to see Dad in all of his goodness, his love of people, his deep cheerful faith in humanity. I was freed from my cynicism, partly from dozens of customers over the years when I go back for class reunions, telling me how much they liked my dad, and employees telling me that he was the best boss they ever had. And Abe Kane coming up to me, one of the poorest kids in town, saying, you know, I'll never forget your father. He always used to show up at our house with bags of groceries for us. So when I think about those stories and the years it took me to dissuade myself from my negative beliefs, I ask myself the question, what fears, tensions, insecurities might be keeping me from fully engaging with people now, fully counting other people in my life? I encourage you to think about that. What blocks do we have to fully engaging and with people? Second, I believe that by sharing stories with and experiencing the lives of others in depth, we come to live, to actualize the belief that everybody counts. It's to be lived. For me, this happened most profoundly after college, when from 1964 to 69, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Malawi. I was a high school teacher in Thailand and directed an ESL program in Laos. I was so excited to be in those countries. I was so curious. Everybody counted. So I sought out everybody from the janitor to, yes, the prince, who hung out in a barbecue restaurant and let me pick up the bill, or just said, give the bill to him. I smiled. I laughed at myself. I listened a lot more than I talked. I asked simple questions and followed up with even more. I heard a lot of stories from artisans, teachers, waitress, taxi drivers, and others. Many spoke limited English, so a lot of it was with sign language and through interpretation. In fact, in Thailand and Laos, I surprised myself by learning how to speak Thai and speak Lao. And I had been the worst in my Peace Corps class at the African language. Change is possible. Through all this, I embraced the differences. But in fact, as Bev said earlier, the similarities were really more significant than the differences. I was, I think, accepting Virginia Satir's adage, in our similarities we connect, in our differences we grow. But even a more complex time was to come, and it should, as we grow older, to take on more responsibilities. Enthusiastic about my foreign experiences, I went back to school in cultural anthropology, whose foundations were in participant observation, which means listening to people's stories, observing, being with, and finding patterns in culture. I returned to Thailand for 2 years of dissertation research, and after that, coming back to Seattle where I was studying, there are the Lao refugees on the streets of Seattle. And so to extend the graduate period time, I started volunteering to help them get resettled. This led to positions in Seattle and Washington, D.C., and 10 years in Southeast Asia working in refugee camps with refugee education. And then that was followed by 7 years working for Peace Corps staff, and then now organizing and leading small group trips to Asia. Each of these jobs presented challenges. But what I have to say really is that in these situations from 1980 on, I have faced cross-cultural, multi-ethnic situations in which those involved have very different ways of seeing, believing, communicating, and in fact, different interests to protect. In these projects, we definitely had our differences. But in most instances, everyday folks, host country staff, showed me that the key to success in the work project was to share stories, to get to know each other, to have fun and have laughter, and to have food and to have more food and to have some more food, and to develop connections that would underlie the work. There are so many stories I'd love to tell you, so many corrections that people helped me make so that I stayed away from just focusing on the work. But the most profound event for me in this area where I needed to be with differences and still work to make something happen was in a volunteer experience when I met the first week in America a refugee family in which the mother had lost her kidney function the first week. She knew nothing about Western medicine. She spoke no English. She spoke no Lao. She spoke no Thai. And so in that first week, I stayed with the family, and I would listen to the wife would say something in her dialect to her husband in Thai and Lao. He'd tell me. I'd talk to the nurse and the doctor. We'd go back this way, in and out of the hospital, 7 times in 5 months. Their story touched my heart. We wove a story together. The kids were tiny, 5 and 7. They are now our children, our spirit children, and their children are our grandchildren. Once again here, the story comes out that what we had in common was much more important than the differences, but we can draw on the differences to make a difference as well. I learned again and again that in stories lie our connected humanity. Stories, little stories, pieces of stories, bits of stories, not necessarily the whole long gamut of our lives at one time. Would you join me in a project in our fellowship related to the above themes of everyone counts and the power of stories? This is a project without leaders. It's a project without meetings. My proposal is that each of us goes about our UUFSD activities. And in doing so, we commit to sharing our story more deeply, letting people know what our path is, letting people know how they can support our path. And probably more importantly, for some long-winded guys like me, soliciting and deeply listening to the stories of others. It's the same thing that our other speakers said, that, and I would encourage us to not only ask the stories of those we know and feel comfortable with, but that we might ask those that we know little about, talk to them, or even take a real risk and talk with people whom we are avoiding. How many people do you know in this place that you have a hat on? Well, she looks like Auntie May. Or he has a face like so-and-so, and so we avoid them. What if we really said, I'm going to try to take off the hat of some of those people who look like so-and-so and stop making our assumptions? This is only part of a continuation of what the patio ambassadors and the ushers are doing. There's some wonderful discussions in that group about helping people connect and to tell our stories. I bet this would enrich us really deeply. And if we're going to follow our principles, darn it, we ought to do it. We ought to start our own underground story corps. You know story corps? Not recording our stories, but sharing our stories and getting the richness out of it. I'd like to finish with the idea that everybody counts, that we can count by telling and listening to our stories. And I'd like to read the first part of a poem by William Stafford, a very lovely poet from Kansas, and then the poet laureate of Oregon. It's called A Ritual to Read to Each Other. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. Thank you so much. May we know each other more fully. And may we and our stories thrive. Thank you.